So we spoke about the bhakti culture in the last two sessions and gave a resume of what Bhaktivinoda Thakur was saying. But he also wants us to have a look at the obstacles that may impede our implementing these five areas of cultivation he discussed with us. So we'll do that. He tells us that there are 10 types of forbidden activity if we actually want to practice the bhakti culture. Association with the materialist, establishing unfavorable relationships, attempting huge projects, spending time studying different works and various philosophies, meanness, being subject to lamentation and other such afflictions, disrespect to the devatas, giving trouble to other living entities, seva and nam aparad, and tolerating criticism of Krishna and his devotee. So very, very interesting. Well, let's begin by looking at the first one. He's talking about association with materialists, and he begins by telling us of the 6 types of materialists. People devoid of faith in Krishna and without moral standards, people with morals but no faith in God, people with morals and faith in God who accept God but don't have a concept of God as subservient. They see him as subservient to morality.
I'll repeat that again.
People with morals and faith in God but whose concept of God is subservient to morality. Pretenders and their followers, impersonalists and polytheists. Now in Bhakti Aloka, he gives a slightly different understanding. So I'll also include this in our discussion. He tells us that materialist means jnanis, kamis, yogis, demigod worshippers, dry logicians, atheists, and sensitaries.
Hmm.
So just to get a more rounded picture, because it's by the same author, he's saying it in a different place. And he tells us that association, we're not talking about being in the same meeting, bathing in the same place, or if you're at a river, or buying goods in the same store. We're talking about it in the same terms as Bhaktivinoda Thakur does in Bhakti Loka. We're talking about NOI for
6 loving exchanges.
Yeah, 6 loving exchanges. So he's talking about association that means dealing with materialists in an intimate mood. And he makes it very clear that to carry on such activities would be asat sangha.
Mataji, questions now or later?
You can take now.
Okay, like part of our families are like that, you know.
Yeah.
And we do invite them for prasadam and things like that.
Yeah.
So it is like a loving exchange.
Not necessarily. Maybe what we'll do is first we'll have a look at why non-devotee is such a problem, and then we'll read the Bhaktivinoda Thakur article, just to refresh your memories. It's a very important article for understanding how to deal with this kind of circumstance that you're raising. It's very helpful to understand what it means in terms of how it affects us to associate with materialists. This is from Madhya 22, 88 to 90. By association with worldly people, one becomes devoid of truthfulness, cleanliness, mercy, gravity, spiritual intelligence, shyness, austerity, fame, forgiveness, control of the mind, control of the senses, fortune, and all opportunities. One should not at any time associate with a coarse fool who is bereft of the knowledge of self-realization, and who is no more than a toy animal in the hands of a woman. So, it's not a very pleasant picture. We don't really want that kind of thing. But let's have a look at the article that Bhaktivinoda Thakur has given us. It's revolutionary, and it gives us a very clear understanding of how we deal in different societal circumstances. Obviously, we have family commitments and responsibilities. We have to deal with them. It's part of being grihastha. But have a listen to what he says. This is from Bhakti Aloka. What is association and giving up association? Many people have doubts about this. Doubts may be there because if just by coming close to a materialist, a material object is considered associating with him, then there's no way to go out this association. As long as the material body is there, how can one give up the proximity of these things? How can a Grihastha Vaishnava give up his family members? Even if one is a renunciate, he cannot give up the association of people. One will have to come across materialists in one's life, whether one is a Grihastha or a renunciate. Therefore, the limit for giving up the association of materialists is prescribed in Sri Upadeshamrita as follows. And then he gives the six loving exchanges: offering gifts in charity, accepting charitable gifts, revealing one's mind in confidence, inquiring confidentially, accepting prasad and offering prasad are the six symptoms of love shared by one devotee and another. O sadhikas, one must accept proximity with both bad and good people as one passes his life. This eagerly applies to householders and renunciates. Proximity must be there. Nevertheless, one should not engage in bad association. Giving in charity, accepting charity, revealing one's mind, hearing one's mind, accepting food and giving fruits, if done with love, these are called sangha or association. Giving some foodstuffs to a hungry person and accepting some charity from a pious man is done out of duty, not out of love. Even if they are materialists, this type of engagement is not considered association. But if they are pure devotees, then such activities should be performed out of love. When acts are performed out of love, then it is association. Therefore, giving charity to pure Vaishnavas and accepting items of wealth from them becomes satsanga. Giving charity to a materialist or accepting charity for one if done out of love becomes asatsanga. You getting the point?
Yes, yes.
Okay. When a materialist approaches you, whatever is required to be done should be done only out of duty. One should not speak confidentially with a materialist. Generally, there is some love involved in confidential speaking. Therefore, it is association. While meeting a materialistic friend, one should speak only what is extremely necessary. At that time, it is better not to exhibit heartfelt love. But if that friend is a proper Vaishnav, then one should accept his association by speaking to him with love. This type of behavior with relatives and friends creates no hostility. There is no association in behavior in ordinary talk. One should behave with ordinary people as one externally behaves with a stranger while buying something in the market. The same dealings with the pure devotee of the Lord should be done out of love. If one is obliged to feed hungry people, needy people, and teachers, he should do so as a host dutifully cares for his guests. There's no need to exhibit love. Care for them, but not out of love. That's a very nice point.
Yeah.
Yes,
you care for them, not your stone heart.
Yeah.
You care for them, but you don't do it out of love. One should feed pure Vaishnavas with love, and when required, accept the remnants given by them with love. If one can behave in this way while giving in charity, accepting charity, speaking confidentially, hearing confidentially, and accepting food with one's wife, children, servants, maidservants, strangers, and whoever else one meets, there is no unholy association, only good association. There is no hope of achieving devotion to Krishna until one gives up unholy association in this way. Mm-hmm. So it's a fabulous article. Mm-hmm. It makes it very, very clear what we need to do to continue to, you know, respectfully associate with different people that we deal with socially, but not get implicated in our satsanga. Mm-hmm. So it's a very wonderful insight that he gives there in Bhakti Loka. And then he goes on to unfavorable relationships. This is very much in the mood of the first one. This is a little bit more detailed. And here he tells us that there are four types of unhealthy relationships. Relationship with disciples that may be unhealthy, with associates, with servants, and with friends. By taking unqualified people as disciples for wealth and power, great disturbance is created in the sampradaya. The Vaishnav should not initiate disciples if there are no qualified people. By taking association of those who are not devotees, many sinful types of habits appear. We just read about that. Therefore, such association should be given up. It is also not beneficial to take servants unless they're devotees. And in making friendships, The devotee should first consider if that person is a Vaishnava. It's pretty self-explanatory, but Prabhupada does make quite some comments on two aspects of what we're talking about here. Actually, one point that he stresses very strongly is about taking unqualified disciples in Nectar of Devotion. He speaks about it at length, and I thought it worth reading. This is from the chapter Evidence Regarding Devotional Principles, and it's under the heading Not Accepting Unfit Disciples, Constructing Many Temples, or Reading Many Books. In the 7th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, 13th chapter, verse 8, Narad Muni, by discussing with Maharaj Yudhisthira the various functions of the different orders in society, especially mentions rules for sannyasis, those persons who have renounced this material world. One who has accepted the sannyas order of life is forbidden to accept as a disciple anyone who is not fit. A sannyasi should first of all examine whether a prospective student is sincerely seeking Krishna consciousness. If he is not, he should not be accepted. However, Lord Chaitanya's causeless mercy is such that he advised all bona fide spiritual masters to speak about Krishna consciousness every day. Therefore, in the line of Lord Chaitanya, even the sannyasis can speak about Krishna consciousness everywhere. And if someone is seriously inclined to become a disciple, the sannyasi is always ready to accept him. But there's another stricture that if a person has, he may have many disciples, but he should not act in such a way that he will be obliged to any of them for some particular action or some favor. The one point is that without increasing the number of disciples, there is no propagation of the cult of Krishna consciousness. Therefore, sometimes, even at a risk, a sannyasi in the line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu may accept even a person who is not thoroughly fit to become a disciple. Later on, by the mercy of such a bona fide spiritual master, the disciple is gradually elevated. However, if one increases the number of disciples simply for some prestige or false honor, he will surely fall down in the matter of executing a Krishna consciousness. So very interesting what he's saying there. He doesn't elaborate on anything else that's mentioned here. So we're going to the third one. This is giving up unnecessary endeavors. And what he says here is interesting. Devotees should give up enthusiasm for big endeavors in the following three situations. So not only give up the endeavor, but give up the enthusiasm for it. Devotees should give up enthusiasm for big endeavors in the following three situations. If there are no funds for a project in the beginning, the work should not be attempted.
Wow.
Because what we're talking about here is things that are going to protect us in our cultivating our bhakti culture. So obviously if you've got a head full of worry about how to meet bills, that's not going to happen.
That's an absorption then.
That's an absorption instead of no. So it's interesting what he's saying here. Devotees should give up enthusiasm for big endeavors in the following three situations. One, if there are no funds for a project in the beginning, the work should not be attempted. Two, if a person's life is nearly over, they should not start a big project. Three, if the work requires a lot of help and there is no way of getting assistance, then the work should not be attempted. Such things create an obstacle to the practice of bhakti. He goes on to say, if huge projects for temples, halls or ashrams are difficult to execute, then they should not even be considered. So interesting. Actually, I wanted to read you something that Prabhupada says about this. He makes some interesting points on the same thing from a different angle of vision, but also with the same concern that we don't get overly involved. He says, it is a sannyasi should not be enthusiastic about constructing temples. We can see in the lives of various acharyas in the line of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that they are not very enthusiastic about constructing temples. However, if somebody comes forward to offer some service, the same reluctant acharyas will encourage the building of costly temples by such servitors. For example, Rupa Goswami was offered a favor by Maharaj Man Singh, the commander-in-chief of Emperor Akbar, And Rupa Goswami instructed him to construct a large temple for Govindaji, which cost vast amounts of money. So a bona fide spiritual master should not personally take any responsibility for constructing temples. But if someone has money and wants to spend it in the service of Krishna, an acharya like Rupa Goswami may utilize the devotee's money to construct a nice costly temple for the service of the Lord. Unfortunately, it happens that someone who is not fit to become a spiritual master may approach wealthy persons to contribute for temple constructions. If such money is utilized by unqualified spiritual masters for living comfortably in costly temples without actually doing any preaching work, this is not acceptable. In other words, a spiritual master needn't be very enthusiastic for constructing temple buildings simply in the name of so-called spiritual advancement. Rather, his first and foremost activity should be to preach. In this connection, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj recommended that a spiritual master print books. If one has money, instead of constructing costly temples, one should spend his money for the publication of authorized books in different languages for propagating the Krishna consciousness movement. So it's always nice to hear what Prabhupada has to say on different things. The fourth point is studying of many scriptures. And what Bhaktivinoda Thakur is talking about here is spending time studying different works and different philosophies. He's not saying that we shouldn't study bhakti shastra that's going to help us advance in Krishna consciousness. It's an essential thing to do. But what he's talking about is this idea of just wasting your time reading this philosophy, that philosophy. It really is a waste of time. And then he goes on to say that we have to be careful how we study bhakti shastra. We shouldn't read small parts of large words without completing a full study. If we're going to read something, we should read it thoroughly. Otherwise, he says that we'll become uselessly opinionated professional debaters. Some people take pleasure in arguing with any statement they hear, whether good or bad. This is forbidden for devotees. So even with our own reading, he's saying, if you're going to read something, read it thoroughly, study it thoroughly. Don't just skip from here to there. So very nice point he's making. The next one, the fifth one, is miserliness, being miserly. What he says is very interesting. Miserliness is very contaminating for devotees. There are three kinds of miserliness: behavior, wealth, and effort. With the Vaishnav, devotees should stand up when he approaches and care for him attentively. We're talking about miserliness of behavior. Devotees should give general respect and gifts to brahmanas. They should properly clothe and shelter their dependents. They should take items from others for a suitable price. They should pay taxes to the king. Devotees should show gratitude to benefactors, give food to the poor, medicine to the sick, and cloth to those suffering from cold weather.
Can you repeat the name of the book and page number?
I'm reading from Sri Chaitanya Shikshamrita, Third Rain, 421, page 121. So very interesting. If devotees treat everyone in the world properly, then the fault of miserliness will not arise. So very interesting point, taking in so many aspects. And what we're really looking at here is the basic quality of a Vaishnava is daya, is mercy, respect, service, the qualities of a servant, Krishna servant. So it's just very sweet what he's saying here. If having nothing else to offer, then it is even enough that devotees simply speak nicely.
Yes, sweet words.
Sweet words. By proper speech, by wealth, by their own labor, devotees should behave generously with others. Lack of proper behavior is forbidden for devotees. So very, very interesting. Because it also indicates as an idea that there may be some lacking if I give. You know, I may lose something if I give. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur told us the only lacking is Krishna consciousness. And just by a sweet word, what's that going to cost you?
Yeah, and sometimes it could just be, especially in case of wealth, it could be just over-attachment to wealth.
Oh, for sure.
And then people kind of make an excuse that this is Krishna's money, we should use it wisely and not use it at all then.
Yeah, we not even come across a lot of these cases, so we preach on this point.
This is a very good way to preach.
Yes, right. That's right.
And the other point, the other point is that according to Manasamhita, if we want to be properly situated socially, like live peacefully without envy, all these things, that we should give in charity according to our how we're manifesting our wealth. Because if we're manifesting a lot of money, throwing a lot of money around, and we're cribbing over 10 rupees with a rickshaw wallet, it's going to create a hostility and an envy. But if you have money and you're always giving out prasad, it seems that you're helping the poor, you're helping the old, then people don't think twice about it. They're not going to think about robbing you. It just won't enter their hearts to do like that. So it's just a common sense thing when it boils down to it, that we just look at things a little sensibly. So the sixth thing that he talks about is lamentation. He's talking about a number of other bad qualities also. Devotees should not be controlled by lamentation and other emotions, by bad habits, by intoxication, or by superstition. There are thousands of circumstances for feeling lamentation, grief, anger, fear, greed, and illusion. But the devotee does not become affected when such circumstances arise. These emotions weaken the mind and obstruct the cultivation of bhakti. The devotee should always be on the alert. Then he quotes bad habits that are also problematic. Bad habits such as sleeping during the day, sleeping during the early morning hours, chewing betel, untimely eating and drinking, unkindly cleaning of the body, sleeping on a luxurious bed, eating luxurious items. Eventually all of these become a disturbance to bhakti. The devotee should take only what is necessary to maintain life, while avoiding habituation to unnecessary items. That's an interesting point also, that we don't become addicted to things that are unnecessary. Tasting intoxications gives rise to many faults. By addiction to intoxicants, bhakti becomes contaminated. Alcohol, maharanya, opium, even tobacco must be avoided by a Vaishnava. And being controlled by superstition causes many problems. From superstition arises prejudice. With prejudice, there is no respect for truth. And he gives an interesting example. For example, wearing the signs of the Vaishnavas is one of the methods of cultivating bhakti involving the body. Nonetheless, to think that these signs alone are the principal distinguishing characteristics of a Vaishnava is superstition, arising from partiality towards one's own sampradaya. Controlled by such beliefs, a person may not respect a real Vaishnava who is not wearing these signs.
So it's external and...
Yeah. So very, very interesting. I wanted to have a look at this a little bit because the intoxication, all these things, if anyone that's seriously following Prabhupada's process, it's not really going to worry us.
Yeah.
But this thing of lamentation is a big number.
He's poking me because he thinks that I suffer from it real bad.
Okay. So the thing is that I want to have a look at that, and I want to look at it first by just telling two little short stories. My last trip out of India, there was some trouble with the plane. I was flying Singapore Airlines. So we stopped over in Singapore, and they accommodated us overnight while they were repairing the plane. And they put us up in a 7-star hotel. I was on the 7th floor of the 7-star hotel. And I was just taking rest. It was quite late at night, taking rest. And all of a sudden, I was woken up by screaming sirens and yelling people and all this other stuff. I didn't really worry too much about it. I just went back to sleep. But when I woke up in the morning, I came to know that the top, very top of the hotel was a huge penthouse, which would cost thousands and thousands of American a night for people to stay there. And a very wealthy young couple had been staying there for a few days. And I came to learn that they were planning their next world tour. Hmm. And they had a disagreement because the wife wanted to take their dog.
Oh, okay.
And the husband didn't. So they argued about it, and then she got more and more distressed about it. You know, this lamentation that the boat, the dog was going to be left behind. And what she'd done that night, all the sirens and screaming and everything, she'd walked off the top floor of the penthouse and committed suicide. Because the dog couldn't go on the world tour with it. So what I'm getting at is that this lamentation has got to do with the mind and our attachments. It's got not to do with the circumstance.
Yeah.
Circumstantially, she's young, she's extremely wealthy.
Yeah.
She has everything in her facility. She's living in a penthouse that most people can't even dream about, let alone afford for one night. But she walks off the top floor of it and commits a suicide because of a dog.
Wow.
You know, the other story is the other side of the coin. Out at Ushigan, the birthplace of Lalita Devi, the person who actually built up that sacred site, his name was Madan Mohan Das Babaji, very wonderful Vaishnava. And he was very, very dedicated. He was there from the days where it was just a hill, and he would have to, you know, walk up and down a long way just to carry water for his puja and things. And he built it up into a very nice place which devotees can go to and, you know, like meditate on and talk about Lalita Devi and Braj in general. And as he got older, he got increasingly ill, and his body broke down quite rapidly because he'd been through so many austerities over so many years. But he didn't want to do anything about it. He was just very dedicated to his service to the deities and serving the guests and like that. But it got so bad, his health got so bad, that the Brijbasis kept harassing him. No, we want to take you to Delhi, we should take you to Delhi. You need to have tests, maybe there's something seriously wrong, you're in a lot of pain, you're incapacitated. And he kept refusing. And kept doing his service, despite the pain and the inconvenience. But then one day he was in really, really, really terrible condition. And the Brijbasi said to him, "We don't care what you say. We're going to go and get a car, and we're going to take you to Delhi, and we're going to test you and get you properly treated." And they went off to get the car. And he left his body at that time.
Wow.
He didn't want to leave his service. So there's the extreme opposite, that he's in, you know, agonizing pain. He's in an isolated area, no medical support, but he doesn't want to leave the place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a healthy attachment.
Okay.
You get the point. So I thought to have a look at this whole question of why am I miserable? This idea of lamentation. I'm going to have a read first from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Because when we have some kind of philosophical understanding, practical philosophical understanding of what we're dealing with, then we have a different outlook. For example, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he tells us in his bhajans that he rejoices whether he's in pain or joy. Now, any materialist would look at that and say, this man's got problems. But the reality is that philosophically speaking and very practically speaking, if we're suffering, it's because of offences, it's reaction to offences, or it's reaction to a past sinful activity.
Mm.
And we go back a long way. It's not just this body that we're dealing with. And if we're experiencing material happiness, we're burning out piety. So both have to go. You have to become free of both to go back home. So, you know, we rejoice at both. Both have their place. We're not thrown over the scale one side or the other.
Yeah.
So let's have a look at this, because it really makes it very clear that, wait a minute, it's not the circumstance. It's more your conditioned mind and your attachments. Have a listen to this. This is from Madhurya Kadambani's second shower. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur explains that the miseries we suffer are born of anattas arising from past sins. He, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, identifies five kinds of misery and explains their essential and characteristic natures. Avidya, ignorance, to mistake that which is impermanent to be permanent, that which is full of misery to be blissful, that which is impure to be pure, and that which is not the self to be the self. Now, I'm reading through this, I want you to just check, do a little reality check with yourself. When do you feel lamentation? I'm sure that you'll find it'll fit in one of these five categories. So listen very carefully. Second one, ashmita, false ego, the bodily identification of I and mine, the acceptance of only direct sense perception as real, abhinivesha, material absorption, instinctively clinging to bodily enjoyments and fear that death will deny us these enjoyments. Rag, attachment, the desire to obtain material happiness and decrease suffering. Our whole civilization is about that.
Yeah.
Dvesha, hatred, aversion to unhappiness and what is seen as the cause of such unhappiness. It covers pretty much everything. So I just wanted to raise that with you so that we get a little bit of a balanced idea of what we're dealing with. Mm. It's not the circumstance. People can be in terrible circumstances like this Babaji I just mentioned. Most materialists would completely freak out in that circumstance.
And they would be the first ones to take a taxi to Delhi and get themselves checked.
Yeah. It's not the circumstance. It's the mind and intelligence.
Two questions asking, maybe.
Sure.
Later, should I ask?
Yeah, ask them now.
Regarding this attachment and what topic we're discussing?
Lamentation.
Yeah. So sometimes we see devotees, they lament because, you know, they are getting one spiritual activity and they are missing out on the other activity, which is obviously not part of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So they lament. And they, what happens is because they're lamenting of the one that they could not have, and they are not getting the full benefit of the spiritual activity they are doing, because they spend their energy lamenting about the one they could not have.
Okay.
Like some teachers, like Albert Schwab, said that, you know, you cannot have two things simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Saying one to yes to one, then that means you're saying yes to a higher one.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no need to lament.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, what would you say that, you know, when devotees do that? That they lament on one spiritual activity being lost because the other one...
Give me an example.
Oh, so many examples in the Mataji. For example, if somebody is in Delhi doing service and not able to attend something here.
Oh, okay.
You know, like maybe your class if they're not able to attend.
Okay.
So then they lament.
Okay.
So, you know, what is the...
Well, the other thing is that there's different kinds of lamentation. What we're looking at here is material lamentation.
Right. So that's why I said that is totally different from this.
Yeah. I mean, if we look at Saranagati, it's full of lamentation.
Yes.
But it's spiritual.
Spiritual.
And it's purifying.
Yes.
It's leading to repentance, and then he actually is making advancement from that.
Right.
Oh, he's telling us how we can do it.
Surely.
He doesn't need to make any advancements. But here we're looking at the kind of lamentation that's mundane.
Right.
Looking at mundane lamentation. Obviously, the Vaishnava that's very dear to you passes away, you have a lament.
Surely.
Isn't it?
Yes.
So, or if a devotee leaves and you can't get them to come back to Prabhupada's movement, you're going to lament.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about that kind of lamentation. Sure. We're talking about mundane.
Yes, okay.
Lamentation.
Okay.
Uncontrolled mind, basically.
And also, Mataji, regarding this, somewhere we were reading about the health. So also I have a question that sometimes some devotees do not take care of the health.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some devotees who suggest that one should take care of the health, then they are advanced devotees only because if at a younger age you do not take care of the health, then later on you will not be able. Right now, even if you don't take care of the health, you can still do service and still exist and, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
But they suggest that you should, because otherwise, as you grow a little older, then, you know, your services will reduce, your bhajan will reduce. So what they're saying is that you have to spend time right now in health. Obviously, if you're taking care of the health, then you're wasting sort of a time. You know, some people say it as waste of time, and some people will say that it is proper utilization of time, because this will make you do bhajan and service in the long run.
So you know what? Basically, what we're looking at, those who say that take care of the body, and includes our acharyas, we're looking at mode of goodness, long-term planning, and it doesn't have to be a waste of time. You can be hearing lectures. You can be doing so many things while you're doing whatever you have to do to keep the thing functional. So it doesn't have to be a waste of time. It can be a very valuable time for hearing.
Yes.
And it's a responsible thing to do, because we have to remember that the body is given by Krishna. And we want to get full utility out of it.
Right.
You know, we want to chant as long as we can.
Right.
We want to serve as long as we can. So if we don't take proper... It's like, you know, this gets back to the thing that we are such impersonalists. You know, we take first-class care of our car. And the house will get a good paint every few years.
Yeah.
But we don't take care of our body.
Right.
And the body is Krishna's temple.
Yeah.
It's the vehicle we're running around in, and Krishna's a passenger. Around the form of the super soul.
Yeah. It's the most important of the things compared to the house or the car.
Yeah. Of the possessions we have, the body is very important.
Yeah.
So if you've got half a brain, you'll take care of it.
Yeah.
So you can get proper use out of it.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, totally makes
sense. Okay. Next one that he goes on to talk about is disrespect to the devatas. This is a very interesting one. I read what he says. Devotees should not disrespect the devatas. There are two kinds of devatas: incarnations of the Lord and jivas with a special qualification. None of the Lord's servants should be disrespected. Those souls who by the mercy of the Lord have attained positions to control and protect the world are considered devatas and are to be worshipped by all. The Vaishnav should not disrespect them out of envy. Giving them proper respect, the Vaishnav may pray to them for the boon of bhakti to Krishna. Very interesting. Now there's a few things that I wanted to raise here, why we should actually respect them. And they're interesting. I'll read the first one from Nectar of Devotion. This is, again, in Evidence Regarding Devotional Principles under the heading of the Demigods. And Prabhupada says here, one should not reject or offer due respect to the demigods. One may not be a devotee of demigods, but that does not mean that he should be disrespectful to them. For example, a Vaishnava is not a devotee of Lord Shiva or Lord Brahma, but he is duty-bound to offer all respects to such highly positioned demigods. According to Vaishnava philosophy, one should offer respect even to an ant. So then what to speak of such exalted persons as Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma? In the Padma Purana it is said, Krishna, or Hari, is the master of all demigods, and therefore he is always worshipable. But this does not mean that one should not offer respect to the demigods. So this is an interesting little thing that he says here, but there's an even more interesting one in the chapter 36 of Nectar of Devotion, where it's talking about Dasya. This is a very different perspective, actually respecting them as devotees. The transcendental mellow of affection has been accepted by authorities like Sridhar Swami as a perfectional stage of devotion. It is just above the humor of neutrality and is a requisite for the development of the serving humor. Devotees engaged in servitude are attached to Krishna in the affection of reverence. And then he goes on, Prabhupada goes on to list four kinds of servitude: appointed servants, such as Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, who are appointed to control the material modes of passion and ignorance. Devotees in servitude are protected by the Lord. Devotees who are always associates of the Lord, like Uddhava. And devotees who are simply following the footsteps of the Lord as a servant, like Raktaka, Patraka, like that. So they actually have a relationship with Krishna and servitude. Then it goes on to say that the demigods, they're called Adikrita Devata. The demigods appointed to particular types of departmental service. Like that. So this is looking at it from one angle of vision, but there's another angle of vision that is also extremely important if you have any sense of self-preservation. Because one thing we have to be aware of is that we can't blink without the permission of a demigod.
Yeah, can't raise our hands.
We can't raise our hands without their cooperation. So if they get nasty, we're in trouble. And sometimes
we're in trouble.
And sometimes they do. You have to listen to this. This is from 11:4:10. I'll read the verse. Indra and his group have been foolish enough to try and seduce, like to actually get Narayana and Rishi to fall down. They're a little bit silly. There's a little statement here about that. This is the verse. The demigods may place obstacles on the path of those who worship you to transcend the temporary abodes of the demigods and reach your supreme abode. Those who offer the demigods their assigned shares and sacrificial performances encounter no such obstacles. But because you are the direct protector of your devotee, he is able to step over the head of whatever obstacle the demigods may place before him. And then the BBT Purport says, although a Vaishnava or devotee of the Lord has no need to worship the demigods, being proud of their exalted material position, sometimes resent the exclusive devotion of the Vaishnava to the Lord and thus try to cause the devotee to fall down, as described in this verse. But the demigods here point out that Krishna is directly the protector of his devotees. Therefore, so-called impediments become stimuli for further spiritual advancement for sincere devotees. The demigods here state, we thought, our dear Lord, that we could disturb your consciousness by our foolish tricks. But by your mercy, even your devotees pay little regard to us. So why should you take our foolish behavior seriously? The word jodi here is used to indicate the certainty that Krishna is always the protector of his surrendered devotees. Although there may be many obstacles on the path of a sincere devotee who is preaching the glories of the Lord, such obstacles increase the determination of the devotee. Therefore, according to Srila Jiva Goswami, the continuous obstacles presented by the demigods form a kind of ladder or stairway upon which the devotee steadily progresses back to the kingdom of God. So the lesson that I want to draw out of this is that we have to be aware that we're dealing with extremely powerful people, and they're not above envy, they're not above malice, and if they happen to notice that we're not treating them so nicely, we may be in for it.
So the idea is just be respectful and always depend on Krishna for protection.
Yeah.
He's our only shelter.
The only, you know, like basically, the only safe position is be surrendered to Krishna. Because if you're surrendered to Krishna, the demigods are not going to come near you. They're not going to tackle Krishna. Mm-hmm. But we're small fry.
Yeah.
You know, always better to take shelter and try and do things ourselves. The eighth point, the eighth obstacle, is violence to other living entities. Like Bhakti Vinod Thakur tells us, the devotee should not disturb other living entities. One type of disturbance is to kill other living beings for food. Talking about the misdeeds of others, criticizing others, quarreling, scolding, bearing false witness, taking advantage at the expense of another, violence, theft, spending the money of another, beating others, lusting over wives of others. These are all actions to disturb others. The devotees should avoid these. When a person takes shelter of bhakti, mercy towards all living entities is a natural quality. Compassion does not have a separate existence from bhakti. The quality which was offered to the Lord is called bhakti or prem, but then becomes friendship, compassion, and indifference when directed towards other living beings. It is a feeling that is inherent in the eternal nature of the soul. In the spiritual realm, this quality manifests simply as friendship, but in the material world it manifests as friendship towards devotees, mercy towards the innocent, and indifference towards the offenders. These are but different aspects of the same compassion. So very interesting. I also thought a good idea to remind us that it's this violence to other living entities is not only a sinful thing, it's one of the aparads. There are four kinds of aparads. Nama aparad, Sevara aparad, Dham, and Jiva aparad. So it's implying that we're not aware that this living entity is part and parcel of Krishna. So if I'm committing violence towards him, I'm committing violence towards Krishna in a very real sense. And that's made very beautifully aware in a very subtle way by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. This is a beautiful meditation from 12.11.24 purport, where he's quoted by BBT. The earth which is always visible to me is the expansion of the lotus feet of my Lord, who is always to be meditated upon. All moving and non-moving living beings have taken shelter of the earth and are thus sheltered at the lotus feet of my Lord. For this reason, I should respect every living being and not envy anyone. In fact, all living entities constitute Kastubhajan on my Lord's chest. Therefore, I should never envy or deride any living entity. Such a beautiful meditation. Because if you do, and they're resting at Krishna's feet are going to feel it. So you have to be very careful. And quite often it's said that when we offend a Vaishnav, the Vaishnav doesn't take offense, but the dust does. Dust of his feet. So that means two things. Krishna's always walking behind his devotee. Krishna will take the offense. He'll be very upset about it. And it also means the followers, those who are following the person that's offended, they'll take offense. And then you've got problems. So what we're looking at here, basically, when Bhaktivinoda Thakur is talking about these obstacles, we're wanting to develop this bhakti culture in a very peaceful and dynamic way. And these are things that are going to create disturbances.
Can you please repeat the reference of the last thing we read from
the Bhagavatam? The last reference was 12.11.24 purport. It's a direct quote from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. The other thing that's interesting to remember is something that's said about violence. It was something that's said in Manasamrita, and that there's three levels of violence: physical, mental or emotional, and spiritual. And in descending order of severity. So the most severe kind of violence is spiritual. You break somebody's faith by your words or activity. And of course the severity of reaction will match. So this is something else we should be very careful about. It pays to watch the tongue. And I think carefully in our interaction with devotees. What's the best thing in the circumstance for everybody involved? Like that.
Yeah. What could be examples of this kind of a thing where a devotee would be breaking somebody's faith?
There are many examples. You have a look, there are hundreds and thousands of examples. Look at all the Gurukul kids. Under spiritual authority, in a spiritual institution, and traumatized, abused. What's that going to do to the kid? Three levels of abuse.
All three.
All three. Physical, emotional, and spiritual.
Sometimes when we are preaching like to our close people and we have been telling them to do something, you know, and they're not improving over the years, initiated devotees and their friends and all, then we are, when we use a little harsher language with them. So that,
better not to. Okay. Better not to, because actually, who are we to talk? You know, and there's that story, I don't know whether I can remember it, but when the demigods were arguing over who was most powerful, and it was between Vayu and I don't know who the demigod of cold is, and Suryadev.
And who?
Suryadev. And they decided that they'd just, you know, play around with a little human. So then, you know, Vayu started off and just, you know, tried to get the person, you know, like to take off, you know, to, I don't know exactly how it went, but somehow or other the person just closed up more when Vayu became very violent, when the winds were blowing very strong. And then cold came in and the person responded in the same way. But when the sun came in, then he took off his jacket. This is a little kid's story I heard years ago. But the point is that, you know, sometimes we have to, even if we have to make a harsh decision, we shouldn't use harsh speech. Because, and we should think very, very carefully, as long as it takes to figure out what the real lesson is, we shouldn't open our mouth. We shouldn't act. When we're very clear, when it's become very, very clear, and we've been getting confirmation about that, even we act, even we speak, we don't do it harshly. Because one of the things that we're unfortunately not aware of enough is that we are chanting mantras. Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. It's a Maha Mantra. Right? And we chant slogans, so many things. There's a potency in our speech. We're not like materialists. They're wishy-washy. They don't have so much. But we have a potency in our speech. This is why you look at the qualities of a Brahmin. They're gentle souls. You know, because if you're very, very harsh and you have that potency of speech, you can crack a heart. Have to be careful. So, you know, like, even if we, and you notice this with very, very, I had the good fortune to have an association of many advanced devotees, and I saw the way they worked when they were dealing with miscreant, you know, devotees. And they could be saying the most, you know, like, heavy-duty things.
Yeah, softly.
But they were saying it softly and they were smiling.
So if you're smart enough, you'll catch it and...
Okay.
You know? We have to be very careful because basically, we're not a spiritual authority. We're babies. Who are we?
Chaitanya Mahaprabhu makes a very good point on the same thing. And he says that we should not chastise because it's the job of a guru.
Yeah.
Unless and until you're thinking yourself to be a guru, we should not chastise. It is not our position at all.
I mean, but sometimes you're in a position where you have to correct.
Yeah.
Because guru also means father, mother, teacher,
yes.
advisor, so many things. Doesn't mean just Diksha Guru, doesn't mean just Siksha, it means so many things. Anyone, whether you're giving spiritual guidance, you're in that position. But we have to be aware that we don't want to alienate the person. We want them to actually become Krishna conscious. So instead of exerting ourselves to try and make them Krishna conscious, it never works.
Yeah,
and force never works.
If they're hurt, then they're not going to, you know.
Yeah,
they'll just disappear. Yeah,
they'll disappear. So better that you just, take the time and effort to think it out properly, and you know the nature of the person, and you approach it on that ground. Is that okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so violence to other living entities. Well, I think that's enough on that one. So we're going now to avoiding offences. He's specifically talking about seva and namaparads. Very interesting what he says. He's talking about seva aparad, and he's quoting Varaha and Padma Purans. And he tells us that the seva aparads are of five types: negligence in spite of ability, disrespect, impurity, lack of determination, and pride. And he tells us that all the offences we can possibly commit to the deity fall within these five types. And he gives examples from the Padma Purana and Varaha Purana. The negligence in spite of ability, not holding regular festivals for the deity, although there's money to do it, worshipping the Lord with inferior items, although there's money to supply superior, not offering seasonal fruits, this kind of thing. Coming before the Lord, not offering obeisances, prayers, like that. Second one is disrespectful offences, like paying respects to the deity using one hand, pointing at the deity with a finger.
Using one hand as in like when we...
Yeah.
There's only one.
Yeah. Yeah. Crying because of material affairs, quarrelling, talking to others in front of the Lord. All these things are offensive. And it's because of disrespect. Offences of impurity, going into the temple with an unclean body or cloth, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he includes thinking of material things while serving the deity.
Oh, okay.
That's also an offence of impurity.
Impure mind.
Yeah, impure mind. Offences because of lack of determination, to take water or breakfast before doing the Lord's service, to eat unoffered food or water, to not see daily the Lord in his worship, not to offer your favourite items, food and fruit, to the Lord, and not observing Ekadasi vow. Offences born of pride. Devotees think of themselves usually as the Lord's humble servants. If they don't, they'll begin praising themselves and think they're the best worshippers. So it's also to offer things with great pomp. Ostentation.
Show,
yeah. It's also pride. And then he goes on to listen to namaparad. So he's mainly dealing with seva aparad and namaparad. But both of these we've dealt extensively with in the Prabhupada, What's So Special About Prabhupada book in chapter 6. So probably better just to have a look at that if we have anything else that you want to know about that. And the last one, the tenth one, is in terms of tolerating criticism of Krishna or his devotee. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that devotees should not consent to or assist in criticism of the Lord or his devotee. If devotees hear such words, they should counter them if possible. If they hear such words from their own guru, then they should humbly warn him. If the guru becomes a hater of Vaishnavas, they should reject him and take shelter of a real guru. So that's quite a heavy statement. But he's referring to Bhaktisandarbha 238. I'll read that in full because it's important we know these things. One should reject a guru who has become arrogant, cannot distinguish between right and wrong conduct, who has taken up an incorrect philosophy. Anyone who hears such a guru teaching wrong principles and the guru who teaches such things both go to hell for unlimited time. Far from being worshipped, such a guru should be given up, especially if he becomes envious of Vaishnavas. One goes to hell with a mantra given by a non-Vaishnava. Therefore, according to the scriptural rules, one should again accept the guru as the Vaishnava. That's from Jiva Goswami, Bhakti Siddhanta 238. So, very important that we take note of that. And also in the Nectar of Devotion, Prabhupada says some interesting things about this. He speaks quite elaborately on it. It's in the, right at the beginning of chapter 9, Further Consideration of Devotional Principles. And the heading is Blasphemy. One should not tolerate blasphemy of the Lord or his devotees. In this connection, in the 10th canto, 74th chapter, verse 40 of Srimad Bhagavatam, Sukadeva Goswami tells Parikshit Maharaj, O dear king, if a person, after hearing blasphemous propaganda against the Lord and his devotees, does not go away from that place, he becomes bereft of the effect of all pious activities. In one of Lord Chaitanya's Shikshasika verses, it is stated, the devotee should be more tolerant than the tree and more submissive than the grass. He should offer all honour to others but may not accept any honour for himself. In spite of Lord Chaitanya's being so humble and meek as a devotee, when he was informed about injuries inflicted on the body of Sri Nityananda, he immediately ran to the spot and wanted to kill the offenders, Jagai and Madai. This behaviour of Lord Chaitanya's is very significant. It shows that a Vaishnava may be very tolerant and meek, forgoing everything for his personal honour. But when it's a question of the honour of Krishna or his devotee, he will not tolerate any insult. There are three ways of dealing with such insults. If someone is heard blaspheming by words, one should be so expert that he can defeat the opposing party by argument. If he is unable to defeat the opposing party, then the next step is that he should not just stand there meekly, but should give up his life. The third process is followed if he is unable to execute the above-mentioned two proper processes, and this is that one must leave the place and go away. If a devotee does not follow any of the above-mentioned three processes, he falls down from his position as a devotee. So this is very, very important because we, you know, Maya Devi is so very, very expert, and, you know, we think that this is extreme. But what Prabhupada is really saying is, this is going to be a major disturbance to your devotional kripa. That's what he's saying. You know, to us, you know, what's the problem? But no, it's a big thing. And, you know, so we have to be aware that, okay, if this is happening, you know, social etiquette may be to stand there and hear it.
But not the Vaishnava.
But it's not what the Vaishnava etiquette says. You walk away from it. If you can't deal with it, you just walk away from it. We don't want to know about it. Mm-hmm. It's a very big... And devotees just don't have this awareness. They think it's real. You know, it's being mature to be talking about this one and that one and what their actual position is. And all. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's actually crazy. Anyway, so in conclusion, Bhaktivinoda Thakur tells us that giving up these 10 detrimental activities, devotees should very consciously and carefully tend to the development of their bhakti through the 5 types of cultivation that we've discussed. Because bhakti is a natural propensity of the soul, and so all attention should be given to its devotional development.
Yeah.
Okay.